online, on digital, and the ABC Listen app.
This is the Country Hour with Callie Buchanan on ABC Radio Queensland.
G'day. How you doing today? Did you manage to get any rainfall over the weekend? It's been a busy 24 hours in the Gulf. Some big falls up there and a little spot in the centre of the map as well. Hope you got some relief from the hot temperatures. Speaking of temperatures, climate change and what it means for farmers is once again dominating global headlines. Last week was all about COP29 and APEC, and this week the issue will take centre stage at the G20 summit in Brazil. Perhaps it's no coincidence then. There's a report out today spruiking the financial windfall on the table for farmers if they host clean energy projects. But of course, in Queensland, there's growing concern and tension around renewable projects and exactly who benefits. Today, I want to know, what would it take for you to support an energy project, whether that's renewable, nuclear or otherwise, near your place? Is the money enough, or would you want to see more in it for others in your community? What would get you over the line? Send me a message on 0487 993 222. Maybe you've already got one. Maybe you've got turbines or panels or something hosted on your property. Let me know. 0487 993 222. Because a report released in Canberra this morning shows that from 2024 to 2030, farmers will receive around $1 billion in payments from renewable energy projects. The report from Farmers for Climate Action and the Clean Energy Council also shows an additional $200 million in payments or electricity bill discounts to regional communities over that same period. Now, farmers, climate campaigners, economists and renewable energy advocates have been at Parliament this morning trying to highlight what they say are the benefits of renewable energy to farming communities. Warwick Long reports.
It's a big headline figure, over $1 billion in renewable energy payments to farmers for hosting projects by 2030. It projects those payments could grow to nearly $10 billion by 2050. Staying with the rest of this decade, it shows Victoria, New South Wales and Queensland are all expecting payments to be over the $200 to $370 million mark, Tasmania just shy of $50 million, and South Australia between $100 and $132 million. One of the farmers in Australia hosting wind turbines is Suzanne Finlay-Tickner on a grain property just north of Horsham, hosting some of the Murra-Warra wind farm in Victoria. She says it's been a big benefit.
This study has actually put a figure to that, to the benefits that come to communities, and that is that clean energy will deliver $1 billion directly to farmers by the year 2030. And I think that just is such an outstanding figure that our regional communities can benefit from that directly.
So from between $0.9 to $1.1 billion in landholder payments for hosting clean energy by 2030 is what the report's saying today. Is that enough?
It's a lot of money, Warwick. It's going to support a lot of farmers to do a lot of innovative things on their farm. And I think also the $200 million to regional communities and councils, I think that's the underlying figure that supports that. I think that's an amazing opportunity for regional communities to grow and prosper with renewable energy projects.
What's the benefit being to you as a landholder with these projects, with this infrastructure on your farm?
So the benefit is obviously financial, first and foremost. We run a cropping operation, and it gives us a second income and a reliable income for our cropping enterprise. Also, Warwick, we have seen the climate change over the last 25 years of farming. We have more unpredictable weather events at different times of the year, and I'm sure everyone has heard, well, not everyone, but I'm sure people in our region have heard the outcome of that hail event that went through a month or so ago up through the cropping region and the devastation that wrought on crops. And what this does, renewable energy brings a secure, reliable income to farmers.
So does it make a bad year easier?
it certainly does make a bad year easier, Warwick, and we might just be finding that out this year with our lack of moisture and hail event that came through at a bad time.
It says, for wind farms, payments to landholders are most commonly calculated on a per megawatt basis, and annual payments typically range between $5,500 to $6,500 per megawatt, suggesting modern turbines have a 7-megawatt capacity. For solar farms, annual payments to landholders, the report says, are commonly calculated on a per hectare basis at a rate of between $750 to $1,250 per hectare per year. In New South Wales, Luke Osborne, who owns a farm with 27 turbines and also runs a consultancy connecting renewable energy companies with regional communities and managing that consultation, suggests the payments from the 27 turbines on his property has helped expand and drought-proof the business.
My farm is called Ellenden. My family's been there for roughly 170 years. And 15 years ago, 27 wind turbines were built. Since that time, we've been able to really improve the farm. Our stocking rate's gone from about 12,000 DSE to 24,000 DSE now. So massive improvement. And
can you describe that? How has a wind farm helped improve your stocking rate?
So firstly, it's allowed us to get to parts of the property and pasture improve. We've been able to move into winter cropping, which has allowed us a grazing opportunity during the tough winter months. It's pretty cold where we are. And secondly, just the income allows you to reinvest in the property. So we've been able to develop parts of the property which were very run down and not very productive and have now turned into, you know, very productive pastures.
How important is the income to the farm?
Look, it's not the biggest income stream, but it's by far the most dependable.
Does it pay for a staff member? Does it pay enough to pay your rates? Like, what are we talking about here?
Yeah, I mean, I know I can pay. I've got two staff members. I know I can pay them. It's enough to make sure that, you know, I can meet payroll for them.
It must give you surety then in terms of looking ahead at the next 12 months when you are doing your budgets and things like that in something like agriculture that has large fluctuations.
Yeah, it's wonderful. You know, farming's a tough business to be in. You know, it's really risky. And to know you've got some dependable income is it's wonderful. I mean, every farm should have renewables on it. You know, if that makes sense to you, Warwick, yeah, it's just makes the business so much better.
This debate, and it's very much still a debate for a lot of people, whether it be the transmission lines connecting these projects up or the development on farm even in generals. What do you say to those communities? What do you say to people about where things are at with renewable and what the future can be for them?
I think this is a very rare opportunity to transfer money from our mega cities to the bush. What effectively is happening is most of the electricity is used and paid for by city people, and some of that money can land in our regional communities. So what I would say is let's look at this as an opportunity to make the most of that very rare opportunity. I mean, I can't really think of another occasion where something like this has happened. Let's use that opportunity. Let's make sure that it works for our farms and our farming communities and our regional communities. My dad talks about the 1950s when wool was £1 a pound and that great time. I think there hasn't been since then an opportunity like this. So I'd say let's work together and make the most of it.
Luke Osborne, who farms on the shores of Lake George in New South Wales and operates a business that helps renewable companies engage with regional communities, ending that report from Warwick Long. It's almost a quarter past 12. This is the Queensland Country Hour. I'd like to hear your view. 0487 993 222. You heard Luke Osborne there say he thinks every farm should have renewables. What's your view? 0487 993 222. Because, of course, large-scale renewable energy projects remain deeply contentious in many regional areas, and the transmission lines required have been met with major community opposition. Particularly, too, we've seen in this state, the Queensland Farmers Federation, among others, call for a more strategic approach to the land used for these kinds of projects. Now, Ellen Litchfield is a pastoralist and a member of Farmers for Climate Action who released the report today. And speaking to Sarah Morris, she acknowledges that not every farmer will benefit from these projects and the windfall that goes along with them.
No, it's not every farmer. It's not every farmer. And one of the key things as well that we found in our consultation is that farmers also really want to make sure that their local community benefits as well, so that there is clean and reliable energy and lower price energy for their local community. We're seeing towns like Walker in New South Wales, which has a large wind farm, getting some payments from the developers that goes into a community fund. So about $1 million a year that goes into a community fund. And that's a really common theme that we found in this report, is that farmers want to make sure that the whole community benefits.
Yeah, and that's an interesting thing, because we've heard from a lot of communities that they feel perhaps they're not benefiting from this transition as a community. There are individual farmers who are making a lot of money. Then there are other farmers who, without any choice in the matter, are having to open up their land to put these transmission lines in, and they're feeling a bit duddered by all of this. Can you understand that?
Yeah, and I think you've sort of really highlighted a very important point, is the choice. And consultation and, that sort of making sure that farmers and community members are included right from the start of the consultation and development process is really important. And one of the other things that we've sort of recognised is, they love the idea of some, best practice developer guidelines. And I think that, building trust and making sure that communities and farmers are consulted right from the start allows that we can really take advantage of this opportunity.
There's obviously money to be made here. No one is denying that. But for other members of the community, they're worried about things like their roads. Because when you put in these massive renewable energy projects, of course, you've got huge trucks and a lot more traffic on your roads. It's damaging the roads. And then the locals get stuck behind these trucks and they're having to drive over potholes. How do we make sure that communities really do benefit? Because there's a lot of talk about communities benefiting, but not all of them are.
Yeah, and I think that, obviously we can't help getting stuck behind the trucks, but money into roads and improving the infrastructure is really important. Our report found it'll be $230 million into communities by 2030, but obviously, that needs to be sort of maintained and discussed, through consultations with communities as well, as that's, it's like you say, those things are ongoing costs.
Do we need to think more strategically, maybe even nationally, about where we're putting all our renewable energy? For instance, you can put the wind farms up, they need to go on the hills, of course, but our solar farms, if you go onto Facebook, you will see plenty of forums saying, why are we putting solar farms on our really good agricultural land where we can grow crops and food? Why don't we put them somewhere else? Would you like to see a national plan so that we do this perhaps a little bit more coherently?
Yeah, and I think there's a really good place for solar farms. Over in South Australia here, we've got quite a few popping up around Port Augusta and in areas that are, farmers can really see benefits of having solar farms, and then, they can graze sheep underneath them, and they're in areas where, they don't mind those, few acres or hectares being taken out. So I think, yeah, we definitely need to work together on how we organise them. And, yeah, like I said, we've got quite a few farmers across the eastern side as well that are with Farms for Climate Action that have got sheep grazing under their solar panels and, are happy with how that works. It's a really important one to make sure we get the location right.
Pastoralist Ellen Litchfield speaking to Sarah Morris. It's 20 past 12. This is the Queensland Country Hour. What's your view? Send me a message on 0487 993 222. Clancy sent a message to say every farm should have some renewables, which is what we heard in the previous story. It's what happens when you spend too long at the Kool-Aid fountain, as it highlights just how little is understood about the bigger picture outside the individual farm gate. You can share your view as well. 0487 993 222 to send me a message. I'd love to hear from you this afternoon. 0487 993 222. Now, later in the program, in fact, up next, They're plentiful, tasty, and consumed around the world. But in Queensland, it's illegal to eat this fish.
I'd really love to give fancy gifts to my kids, but right now just a roof over their head and a hot meal, that'd be great.
You can help support a family who needs it most with ABC Gives.
Join ABC Local Radio and Food Bank to help feed vulnerable Australians.
You'll be supporting local charities to help those most in need.
Give hope to your community. Join ABC Local Radio for ABC Gives.
Donate now at abc.net.au/gives.
On your radio, online, and on the ABC Listen app. This is the Country Hour with Kelly Buchanan on ABC Radio Queensland.
It's a tasty biosecurity nightmare weaving its way through the waterways of Queensland with little chance of eradication. But if you catch tilapia on your fish hook, you better not eat it. It's against the law to eat it wild caught. Now, some in the fishing industry are objecting to legislation and now posing the question, why can't you batter, crumb and deep fry tilapia like the rest of the world can? Abby Holter explains.
While many Australians aren't used to having tilapia on menus, it's a tasty meal in many parts of the world. Served with garlic butter or parmesan crusted, perhaps just pan seared. But on our dinner tables, it's a pest, which is against the law to cook up. Owner of McKay Fish Market, David Carucciolo, says he has a large active infestation of tilapia and wants to take advantage of the accessibility.
And I think it's quite a big infestation. As I said, I'm not sure how west it spreads from the area, but what you said before, that we're not allowed to eat the fish. Now, people import the fish into Australia. We sell it. We've got a lot of nationalities that eat that species of fish. It comes in either head off or gutted and gilled. Now, I think our rules are that we have to, once we catch it, we have to kill it and bury it. Why is there not some mechanism where we can catch the fish, cut the head off behind the petrol fin, bury the head straight away, or dispose of the head into some liquid that you can carry with you, whether it's metho, whether it's whatever. It's another form of protein that we're wasting that we could utilise. The cost of it is quite good. The farming method, brings it down in cost, so it makes it affordable for everyone to eat. And it's probably a fish that they're used to. A lot of people can't go sea fishing, so they're eating farm fish all throughout Southeast Asia and the world. Australian people aren't used to tilapia on their menu or on their dinner table, but I'm sure that with a bit of flavouring and all the rest of it, tilapia is a very white flesh fish. It's not a strong flavoured fish, so you can add flavour to it, like, we have the cream dory or the bass that comes into Australia. Any white flesh fish is not a very strong flavour, so you can do something with that product.
In Southeast Asian countries, like Thailand, eating tilapia is as common as eating battered tropical snapper in Australia. Jessica Turner, an aquatic veterinarian at Namsai Farms, an hour from inner city Bangkok, said proper management of tilapia is the key to growing the fish sustainably.
It depends on how you manage it. Like in our farm, we need to make sure that it don't get out of the farm. We stock like barramundi outside the hapa to make sure that the fish that escape from the hapas, they are not going to escape from the farm because barramundi will eat them all. They are carnivore, right? If the farmer stock them in the earthen pond, when they pump out the water or drain the water out of the farm, they need to make sure that they filter the water before drain the pond, something like that. Well, tilapia is like a main production in Thailand, and it's a very easy species that you can raise, and they are very disease resistant. So, you can raise tilapia easier than any other species. And like comparing to shrimp, you will need to bear the risk of the survival rate. But for tilapia, it's easier to do it. Oh, we export to many countries. We have like the main continent that we export is Africa and also in Asia. For the past 2 years, we export to 10 countries in Africa and 10 countries in Asia.
Senior lecturer with the School of Environment at the University of Queensland, Dr. Ben Moss, says they're usually found close to population centres. And there's a reason for that.
I think the reasons why they're found there, that is that people have gone out there in the past and have released these fish into the environment. Tilapia is known right around the world as an invasive species. It's not only just here in Australia that we find it as a problem, but in other parts of the world, they do farm the species. And so some of those introductions have been from escapees from farms. And tilapia makes a really good fish for farming because it grows quite quickly. It can handle being in not great water conditions. It doesn't mind being crowded, and it pretty much eats everything. My thinking is the rules around not having people be allowed to catch tilapia from the wild and to eat those relates to perverse incentives. If people were allowed to eat tilapia, they might be more inclined to move tilapia from one river system to another, which is closer to where they live, for instance. This would actually potentially cause tilapia to become more widespread than what they already are.
The Queensland Government Department of Primary Industries referred the ABC to previous tilapia regulation statements, which reads, "Allowing tilapia to be caught and consumed promotes the keeping of tilapia and their spread through the creation of new fisheries, for example, stocking in dams or releasing them into rivers."
That story from Abby Holter. Would you eat tilapia? Have you tried it? I know the first time I went overseas and saw it on a menu, I was very confused because I only knew it as a noxious pest. 0487 993 222 if you'd like to send me a message here at the Country Hour today. I've got a message here from Mal in Dalby talking about the earlier stories around renewables. He says, don't call them wind farms or solar farms. Call them factories. Farms are environmentally friendly. That's Mal's view. You can share yours as well, 0487 993 222. Now, from one pest that you can't eat to one that you certainly can, rabbits were first introduced to Australia in the 1800s by the European settlers, and they have very quickly spread and today are estimated to cost in excess of $200 million worth of damage each year to agricultural production. Now, Craig Magnuson from Warwick has plenty of experience when it comes to fighting rabbits, and he's just been elected the chair of the Foundation for Rabbit Free Australia. It's the first time in the 30 plus year history of the Foundation that the position has been held by someone outside of South Australia. He tells Danielle Lancaster about the job and if Australia could ever really be rabbit free.
The Foundation for Rabbit Free Australia is a incorporated not-for-profit environmental charity, and our main purpose is to raise the awareness and promote or advocate, if you like, the need for the continued control of wild rabbits in Australia and the continued research into their control. And so we do a few things around that, and one of them is to support work in research into new biocontrols and making the existing biocontrols we have, making sure they're still doing what we need them to do.
Craig, you're the new chair, and it's the first time in the Foundation's over 30-year history that it's been held outside South Australia. What new perspectives are you hoping to bring to the position?
And I'm really honoured too, by the way. It's been a lot of Australia's most notable rabbit experts have gone before me in the chair position and on our committee as well, so it's a great honour. From the Queensland perspective, and the thing with rabbits, the same goes for all invasive pests, it's not a one-size-fits-all. There's different sets of circumstances right across Australia, but the one thing that remains constant is that none of us can afford to take the foot off the control of rabbits. So in Queensland, we're quite lucky. My day job, if you like, is as Chief Executive Officer of an organisation called the Darling Downs Moreton Rabbit Board. And we're quite fortunate in Queensland that governments had the foresight 130 years ago to build the rabbit barrier fence. And that's one of the key things that our organisation does, and it's been really effective over a long period of time in protecting particularly southern Queensland from the impacts of rabbits. Our fence, and back 130 years ago, there was a lot more fencing too, I should say. Ours is the only one that remains and that's still maintained to this day.
There's quite a few different methods in controlling rabbits. Is there one better than the other, or do people often have to use a few different methods?
So there are a number of different methods, and it largely depends on the circumstances of an infestation. In Queensland, The circumstances are largely different to the southern states for a number of reasons. We focus on the removal of harbour. Rabbits need a stable environment in order to be able to breed. And in Queensland anyway, that's achieved by establishing warrens, underground warrens. So we focus on getting rid of those where we find them to take away the rabbit's ability to breed, because that's its secret weapon. In some of the southern states, rabbits can actually breed. They can get those stable conditions and access to high protein feed without necessarily establishing underground warrens. So that means your control technique differs. The main ones, though, are the biological controls are extremely important. So we had myxomatosis in the 50s and 60s that saw rabbit numbers crash in Australia. They overcome that, built up resistance. And then in the 90s, we had the first of the Khaleesi viruses, or the rabbit hemorrhagic disease virus, RHDV. Those viruses are still out there. There's a few strains of the RHDV now circulating. They're extremely important. However, their efficacy is waning. Rabbits, you know, like I said, they're really good at breeding. Because of that, they can breed resistance to these viruses. So that's out there doing its thing. We really need people to focus on if rabbits have established underground warrens, or they're underneath log piles or rubbish piles or shipping containers, then you need to take away that harbour and prevent them from breeding. The other control methods available are baiting for localised sorts of situations, and then other mop-up sort of techniques, I guess, like, you know, things like shooting and trapping.
It's been said that rabbits affect over 300 threatened native species. We know they change the landscapes, and that they're costing over $200 million a year to our agricultural production here in Australia. Are state and federal governments doing enough?
Well, it's the old story. You know, we could always do with more. Everyone has never got enough to do everything they want to do. What we'd like to see, though, is, you know, we'd like to see surety in funding from all levels of government, not just funding, but continued research into biological controls. We always need to be on the lookout for new weapons in the arsenal, if you like, and not just biocontrol, but, you know, continued research into best practice control methods. So it really does take a commitment from all levels of government, because, you know, the last thing anyone wants is to a return to the old days, pre-Myxo and pre-Khaleesi virus, where rabbits were extremely abundant in the landscape doing untold harm.
Is there anything on the horizon for some new biocontrol methods?
There is some research going on. You know, some of that is looking at the existing biocontrols that we have here in Australia and potentially making them more efficacious, and also looking into whether there's, you know, you're always on the lookout for new strains that evolve. That's the thing with viruses, they continue to evolve. If we think of COVID, that's a really good and pertinent example. There's research projects going on looking into other agents overseas that have impacts on rabbit populations that might have use here. Very long term, though, and nobody wants to see another cane toad released, so there's very strict controls around all of that. So it's a long-term process, and why we need to be continually looking for new agents.
Do you think Australia will be ever rabbit-free?
Oh, you'd like to think so. In practical terms, sometimes out on the ground, it's very hard to imagine that we might be able to, you know, eradicate them. But as some colleagues of mine are fond of saying, eradication's all about scale. If you're a land manager and you want to get rid of rabbits from your patch, it is possible to eradicate them from your patch. And that's probably the key message that we'd like to get out to land managers.
It is illegal to keep pet rabbits in Queensland, and there have been calls from some people that people should be able to keep pet rabbits. What are your thoughts?
Obviously, I'm in the no camp. The argument you often hear is that, you know, it's okay, I'll be a responsible pet rabbit owner, and it would stay inside, and it would do this and it would do that. And the majority of people probably would do the right thing. I always use the analogy, it's similar to pet cats. If everyone did the right thing with pet cats, we wouldn't have such an issue with feral cats that we do today. In Queensland, you haven't been able to keep a pet rabbit for over 60 years or something like that. So let's just imagine what the landscape might look like if you had been able to keep pet rabbits for the last 60 years. And, you know, we might have a much greater problem on our hands than, I'm sure we would, than we do today.
The first non-South Australian chair of Rabbit Free Australia. That's Craig Magnuson speaking with Danielle Lancaster. You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour. It's almost 25 to 1. Plenty of messages coming through 0487 993 222 to send me a message. I've got a message here from Gary at Rocky, who says it's not just renewables and solar farms that take the prime farming land. Gas and mining companies do it too, and he's suggested you have a look at the episode of Landline from the 17th of November, which you can do on ABC iView. Just look for any of the past Landline episodes if you'd like to take a look at that as well. Thank you very much for sending that through, Gary. You can send me a message to 0487 993 222. Up next, there's been a bit of activity around the Gulf today, a look at the weather that's happened today, yesterday, and tomorrow. The Bureau's next.
On your radio, online, and on the ABC Listen app. This is the Country Hour with Callie Buchanan on ABC Radio Queensland.
And you can always catch up on the stories from the Country Hour today or anything that you might have missed last week by heading along to the ABC Listen app. You can do that in your web browser or on your app. It's a handy thing to do, particularly if you find yourself with a weather-related radio outage, as some of our listeners did last week. Let's check in with the Bureau now. Steve Hadley's on duty for us this afternoon. How are you doing, Steve?
Hi, Callie. Very good, thanks.
Now, I see we've had some activity earlier in the morning, but thankfully the severe weather around Burketown in the north has eased a bit.
Yeah, we had a severe thunderstorm warning out for Burketown and Dummagee this morning. So around 70 or so millimetres fell in an hour around Burketown earlier, causing us to issue the warning. They topped up to about 85, 86 millimetres, and it's kind of eased off, but it's also headed out across the Wellesley Islands. So there's been a bit of rainfall around Swears Island and around Mornington Island as well. Mornington Island Airport getting 68 millimetres this morning. So yeah, some good rainfall totals very locally up there, and potentially some more showers and thunderstorms up in the Gulf Country to come today as well. So yeah, hopefully that's a bit of a turnaround after the drier times that some parts have been having of late.
It feels like it's capped off a bit of an active weekend.
Yes, well, we have had storms through the interior through Sunday and even in the southeast of Queensland on the Saturday. So yeah, it's been quite an active weekend. We had to issue a few warnings. There was some flash flooding around Brisbane on Saturday with about 100 millimetres in 3 hours around eastern Brisbane, Logan and Redland. And then it was a pretty calmer day on Sunday. But just going back to Friday night for a second, around the Moonee catchment over there, some places had over 100 millimetres on Friday night to Saturday morning. At Ripple Downs, I think it was called, just in the sort of between the Weir and the Moonee there, just north of Gundawindi. So some quite large totals there, and it does appear to be an annual rainfall record for that particular location too. But elsewhere across the interior, showers and storms were fairly scattered to isolated, and generally totals were less than that through the weekend. But there's some storm activity popping up right now, Callie. I can just see one coming through Charleville at the moment, and another couple of storms heading towards St George. So today's round is just developing.
Well, yes, what can we expect from that activity this afternoon?
So potentially as those thunderstorms rumble through the Marano and Warrego and later into western parts of the Darling Downs and also the Central Highlands, we could see some very isolated severe storm activity through there, potentially with some heavy rainfall and damaging wind gusts if we see any isolated very active storms through that part of the world. So yeah, very isolated spots could see more than 50 millimetres of rainfall, I think, today. Wouldn't rule out 100, but I guess they'll be very isolated, and most places getting a lot less than that, with maybe around sort of 20 to 50 millimetres under the showers and storms today, and again into tomorrow as well, potentially some showers and storms through that area too, and even nudging a little bit further east. But going west of Charleville and through Cunnamulla and the southwest, the trough's already gone through there. So while it's a bit cloudy at the moment, it's also about 5 to 8 degrees cooler than what it was yesterday. So not expecting the 40s today in the Channel Country. Birdsville sitting a bit more comfortably today, with a high expected around 32 degrees.
Well, yes, I was. I'm sure there's a lot of people relieved to see that heatwave warning is really contracted to the north by the look of it. Are we likely to see those temperatures continue to ease?
Yeah, through the most part. Let's talk about the central areas at the moment. So it's been really hot through Longreach over the last few days, expecting 38 degrees today, but 33 tomorrow. Showers and a possible storm both days in Longreach. A good chance of some rainfall coming up, maybe even through Wednesday and later parts of the week too around there. For Emerald, for example, a bit further east, well, it's still sunny today, but tomorrow the trough will get in there and we'll see at least a shower or two, possibly some thunderstorms developing south and west of Emerald, particularly around the Carnarvons and Springshore and that kind of area, with the that possibility of severity further south. But going north of Emerald over the next couple of days, there's not too much weather around, apart from a few showers in the northeast of the state. So, yeah, Rockhampton's staying warm for a little while, 32 and 33 over the next couple of days. Mackay, 31s, partly cloudy or mostly sunny weather until showers increase on Wednesday there. And in Townsville too, temperatures into the 30s with a shower or two developing from Wednesday. And then going up to the Cairns area too, it's all sort of changed really through, from about Wednesday. Temperatures into the low 30s until then, but once we go after that, temperatures will probably overall drop a bit, especially later in the week, and we could see some shower activity increasing up in that part of the world. But as far as that northern tip of the peninsula goes, potentially for a few days yet, we could be in severe heatwave conditions with temperatures well into the 30s in places like Weipa.
Very good to keep an eye on those kinds of warnings, because that has been such a sustained heatwave in that northwest and northern country. It's a lot to take on. I'm sure a lot of tempers would be very frayed at this point.
Yeah, and looking out for the rainfall as well. So I'm thinking, you know, better chance later this week up in the northern peninsula of some good rainfall coming through. And once that starts to happen, we'll be with a bit more cloud cover up there. You know, we're hopeful that temperatures will begin to reduce back to normal, and that bit of rainfall will just be so refreshing, I think, after this long time.
Absolutely. And speaking of refreshing, how are the winds on the coast at the moment?
So, not strong, sort of a bit fresh and breezy through the northern waters, and then through sort of central coast areas. It's quite light at the moment, sort of varying between east and northeast as the sea breezes develop. Right in the far south, we've got a northerly developing today, but once that trough comes through tomorrow, we'll start to see south-southeasterlies developing through Gold Coast waters at some point during tomorrow morning. Not necessarily strong, just sort of around the 20 knot mark. They'll begin to push over the southern waters through the rest of Tuesday and into Wednesday. But, yeah, looking like, apart from dodging all the showers and potentially more thunderstorm activity from Wednesday, it's rather a bit more placid over the coastal waters right now.
It's been a real mixed bag of forecasting today, Steve. Thank you so much for taking us through all the detail. Appreciate your time on the Country Hour.
No worries. Thanks a lot.
Steve Hadley, with plenty of details to keep across. You can keep across them too, and any pop-up storm warnings that happen for your patch by listening to ABC Radio, following your local ABC on Facebook, and at any time you can head along to abc.net.au/emergency. It's 18 minutes to one.
Tennis goes all year, and now so do we. Join me, Catherine Murphy, every Friday on the ABC Tennis Podcast. I'll be joined by former players John Millman and John Alexander.
Well done, JA. You picked the winner.
We'll bring you up to date on all the big stories, as well as how the Aussies are faring on the tour. You'll find the ABC Tennis Podcast on the ABC Listen app every Friday, with bonus episodes available during Grand Slams.
This is the Country Hour with Kelly Buchanan on ABC Radio Queensland.
Continuing the conversation around renewables and farming, you can join in at 0487 993 222. I've got a message here that says, unfortunately, for the sake of our children's quality of life and the quality of the environment, transition to renewable energy must happen. Nuclear is not a viable option. That's one of the views shared on the text line. You can share yours as well, 0487 993 222. To some agribusiness news now, because Elders has gone into a trading halt today after announcing it would be buying another agricultural supplies company, Delta Ag, for $475 million. The announcement comes after a challenging year for Elders with fluctuating market conditions. Revenue declined by 6% to $3.13 billion, while underlying earnings before interest and tax fell 25% to $128 million. Managing Director Mark Allison explains the results to Cassie Huff.
So we ran on October through to September trading year, and it was very, very difficult in the first quarter last year, and that actually had a major impact over the full 12 months results. So in that quarter, over the previous 10 years, I think the average is that we do 32 or so million EBIT, and we finished at zero. And from there, we've been playing catch up, and we put a range out of 120 to 140 million EBIT and came in at 128, so it's just slightly below the midpoint.
And what was the cause of such a dramatic downturn, the dip in livestock prices?
Well, I think there are accommodations. If you recall, 12 months ago, we had the Bureau of Meteorology forecast of El Nino. There's a lot of sell-off of livestock across Australia on the basis they wouldn't have food feed for them. There was also decisions made on cropping that reduced expenditure. There were a whole heap of uncertainties, and that had a major impact right across the board, you know, not just us. And then as it started raining in January, and it clearly wasn't going to be El Nino, and then we had picking up in eastern Australian winter crop, and then through South Australia, although that was difficult, and then much later in Western Australia.
And how are you managing the seasonal differences across the country? You've got a pretty strong season in northern New South Wales, but Western Victoria and South Australia are having one of their worst seasons ever.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think that's one of the debates that's often had is, should agricultural companies be publicly listed? Because it's not quarter-by-quarter reporting on how much soft drink's being drunk or whatever. It's like it is very subject to what comes out of the sky and other issues. That's the beauty with Elders as a public listed company, because we've got multiple diversifications through geographies, which is the normal one, but also through our products, you know, whether it be real estate, agency, rural products, inputs, feed and processing business, our financial services business, and we've got diversifications with channel, where we have wholesale channel, retail channel. So we try to drive all these diversifications and keep a close eye on cost and capital in order to perform consistently as a public listed company.
And what effect will this have on your overall dividend and share price?
So the dividend has been maintained at 18 cents, so the same as last half, with full year at 36 cents. In terms of share price, you may have noted we went into a trading halt this morning prior to the market opening, because as well as announcing our annual results, we've also announced the acquisition of Delta Agribusiness, and that will come out of the trading halt tomorrow morning. We're raising capital to buy Delta, $475 million enterprise value, with the idea that we'll run the two networks individually, separately, so there won't be any reduction in service or community activity or client activity, but it will allow Delta, who's been a private company, to have more access to capital, to grow. They're very strong with their technical service, very good relationships with their clients, and a highly trusted agribusiness as Elders is.
You've said nothing will change. What will it mean for jobs, though, and how long will they be able to retain their offices, given that they could be in competition with Elders' offices in some towns?
Yeah, no, there'll be no changes. So they'll operate as Delta. So the only people changes is that Paul Rossett, our CFO, and I will go onto the board. I'll become chair of Delta, and the rest of it will stay the same. In terms of overlaps, they're very strong in New South Wales, Northwest Victoria, South Australia, West Australia, and it's highly complementary to our business. But they'll remain Delta. They'll be run separately. There won't be any branch rationalisation. The benefits or the synergies that we're envisaging is being able to provide lower priced inputs that will run, because we're bigger, the Elders group will be bigger, and that'll play to the benefit to local farmers as well as to shareholders and our people.
And given that the full year results for 2024 are pretty dismal, what is the outlook for 2025?
Yeah, I think the results it's our third highest profit in history this year, but the outlook is positive. I think generally we assume an average market conditions and average commodity prices, and on the basis of that average, we're already seeing that Q1 FY25 is back to the normal area, like the normal sort of run rate that we had prior to last year. So we feel pretty optimistic and positive. But all things being equal, and as I say, we're not forecasters, but we just assume average conditions across Australia. So some areas will be higher, some areas will be lower, but it's positive.
Elders Managing Director Mark Allison speaking to Cassie Huff. It's 10 to 1. You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour. Now, the nation's peak agricultural machinery body has welcomed news the federal government's right to repair will be reformed, saying it's in the best interest of farmers. So last week, the Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, announced productivity reforms that will give farmers the ability to fix their own headers, tractors and other machinery if they choose. Now, it's a right to repair has existed in the passenger vehicles, in cars for a while, but it hadn't been extended to particularly agricultural machinery. The Tractor and Machinery Association's Executive Director Gary Northover says they will take the lead of the automotive industry when implementing these changes.
These are all an outcome of the initially the work that the ACCC did back in 2020 and subsequently the Productivity Commission review into right to repair, where there are a number of findings, including the fact that recommendations that the motor vehicle information sharing scheme be adapted or adopted for, among other things, agricultural machinery. So this is about giving farmers access to the tools and training and resources needed to be able to perform their own repairs.
So on the farm, in the paddock, what will this actually mean for farmers?
I guess simple terms, if a machine has displayed a fault code in the past, then it's been necessary to call the dealer to bring his diagnostic machine out and examine the cause of the fault and then effect the repairs. What will now be happening, and it is actually happening with a number of our members already, is the repairer or the farmer can purchase that diagnostic tool to carry out his own analysis and then move towards doing repair. So it's making available the tools and the resources to allow farmers to do more than perhaps they have been able to in the past.
You talk about farmers having access to these computers and the software so that they're able to repair things on farm. Do you think that that may be more just, I suppose, those bigger farmers who do have, perhaps they've got a full-time mechanic, or will it mean independent ag mechanics? This is also going to mean a change in direction for them?
Look, I think that's the devil in the detail, is that first and foremost, you know, we find that a lot of the reasons for this being the issue it is because just the lack of skilled tradesmen out there working in the agricultural space, agricultural machinery space. And we've been advocating long and hard to try and, you know, grow that and to get more talent in the field. So that's the first issue. If we could overcome that, then a lot of this would certainly be easier to manage. And I think going forward, there's an expectation that anybody that carries out a certain levels of repairs ought to be sufficiently trained and qualified to do so. And that'll be part of the, I guess, the detail that surrounds what the final piece of legislation looks like. Certainly that's been the case with the Motor Vehicle Information Sharing Scheme. There's been a whole regime put in place there for motor vehicle repairers, third-party repairers, to ensure they're capable and trained and what have you to do that sort of work. So we'd expect similar will happen there.
Because I was going to ask what the implications may be for warranty with machines if a farmer is, you know, using these tools, albeit, you know, software or computers, you know, undertaking these works if they haven't been trained in that area. So how has it been working in the automotive space, and is it something that feasibly could be adapted to heavy machinery?
Well, look, speaking really as an outsider to the automotive space, my understanding is that there's been a pretty rigorous regime put in place for those third-party repairers to meet a certain level of qualification and be viewed to be, I guess, approved to carry out that sort of work. And once you meet that requirement, then those issues you talk about are being effectively managed. We're yet to go down that path of agricultural machinery. Certainly, you know, the question of warranty comes up a lot, and ultimately, you know, you've got dealers out there who, with their third-party repairers, may be performing warranty work already today. But it's just a matter of making sure that it meets the, you know, the criteria of the warranty for the benefit of not just the dealer, but also the farmer himself, so that he'll or herself, that they're not falling into a pitfall that turns into a bigger problem down the track.
Tractor and Machinery Association Executive Director Gary Northover speaking with Tara de Landgraft. And I've got a couple of messages in on 0487 993 222, some long ones with some detail, so I'll paraphrase. But John at Tolga says, we're not farmers but live in view of a mega wind farm. Transmission lines have been built across farmland as long as we've had electricity. I think the pushback against renewables is coming from those originally against climate change, trying another angle of attack. And another message here that says renewables' disregard for biosecurity at the sites is widespread. Who will be held accountable? Renewables are being rushed out to placate politicians with no regard for the ramifications. At minimum, a moratorium is required. Thanks for sharing your view on 0487 993 222. With 5 minutes to go, I'm going to share a brilliant story with you. Because after 5 decades in the saddle, Australia's oldest jockey has hung up the silks, but not without one last fairy tale finish. Most of Keith Ballard's illustrious career has been spent competing in country Queensland races, and as Emily Dobson reports, his final ride took place in his hometown of Mount Isa at the weekend.
1969 was a landmark year.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
It was the year we landed on the moon. Tennis great Rod Laver won his second Grand Slam, and on a racehorse in outback Queensland, a 16-year-old Keith Ballard was making history of his own.
Slow past the 200. Keith Ballard's got a kick. Now Valley of Dreams is...
Riding his first winner of what would become thousands and kicking off a career that would endure over half a century.
Deb was a very good rider. He was the town farrier in Longreach. So I've been around a racetrack as long as I can remember.
Now 71 years old, Keith has been in the saddle for longer than most, earning him the title of Australia's oldest jockey. But it wasn't always a clean start out of the gate.
You know, I was very small. I was only 5'7" back then, which was very tiny. But I always wanted to ride, and Dad's mother used to try and steer me away from it, tell me I needed to trade and everything like that. And Dad's brother, Uncle Jim, said, "Jockeying is a trade, Mum." So he was my backstop.
His hands are marked by decades under the outback sun, but age hasn't made the outback hoop weary.
It's a blood rush. You know, you got your knees up pretty high, and you know, you're doing 80 kilometres an hour, and you're packed in a field. You need to have your wits about you, because you don't just have to think about yourself. You've got to think about all those around you. Probably a little bit more clumsy than I used to be, not as nimble as you'd like to be. But, you know, it doesn't daunt me to jump up on one.
With nearly 2,000 wins across almost 10,000 races, the walls of the Ballard family home in Mount Isa are lined with trophies and accolades.
It's all the newspaper clippings that I've collected over the years.
Documenting the memories and success in races like the Darwin Cup and the Cleveland Bay Handicap.
Birdsville Cup. I've been lucky enough to win it once on Equitant.
And with the thrills, there's been spills.
I've broke legs, I've broke arms. Approximately 12 years ago, I landed upright, but I broke both legs. I was out of the saddle for 9 months with my right ankle, which still haunts me. You know, people suggested to me after I did break both those legs that I should consider retiring, but I really didn't take it serious.
After a chat with his wife Denise, herself a former jockey and current trainer, Keith Ballard says he's ready to hang up the saddle for good.
You know, at 71, I have been thinking about it for a number of years. Well, Denise said to me, if you keep chancing it, you'll eventually crash. Get out while you're in one bit. And, you know, I've been considering it for, you know, the last 3 or 4 years. I've said, this is my last year. And she's probably just given me the push I needed.
A respected name in the industry, the Ballard family, including jockey son Dan, have countless wins between them. In 2021, the trio were inducted into the Queensland Racing Hall of Fame. Keith's son, Dan Ballard, himself enjoyed a 23-year-long jockey career, often racing alongside his father.
Well, it's just always been present in our life. Obviously, Dad's been riding for 55 years, so not only all of Dad's adult life, but all of my life, he's been a jockey. And, you know, the sad days at the races and the horses in the back, and it's just been a constant theme throughout. And, I really don't know what it looks like in the absence of that.
While Keith plans to retire from racing, you won't have to look far to find him. The local track is at his doorstep. He plans to be a familiar face around regional Queensland tracks. But for now, he's making room for more time with the people who matter to him the most.
There'll be a big void there. I'll still ride track work for Denise, and that'll keep me a bit fit. And I love my gardening, and I've got two wonderful grandchildren that will put a few hours into them.
71-year-old Keith Ballard, who capped off his illustrious career aboard his wife Denise's horse Metalbar, winning his last race by more than 5 lengths. Our thanks to Emily Dobson for that story. And that rounds out the Queensland Country Hour for today as well. My name is Callie Buchanan. I'll be back on your radio at midday tomorrow. It's time for the news, 1 o'clock.